making paper.
Welcome to episode number 109 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at the link. Click on Podcast in the menu and look for episode 109. Again, that's HelenHebertStudio.com. Today, I'm talking with Sammy Lee, who studied fine art and media art at UCLA and architecture at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Lee was born in Seoul, South Korea, and currently lives and works in Denver, Colorado, where she operates an artist collective and residency. Sammy Lee's art merges traditions of craft and installation while employing her Eastern and Western identities. Her work blends spatial, human, and temporal boundaries by deploying various materials and processes: paper, sumi ink, books, rubbings, sculpting, and architecture. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Sammy Lee, welcome to Paper Talk. I'm looking forward to learning about you and your journey with paper. So, let's start out just talking a little bit about how did you get interested in paper or art? Where did you grow up and all of that?
Yeah, I grew up in South Korea, and I was there until I was turning 16. That's when I chose to move to the U.S. I had some like relatives living in Southern California. And until then, I guess papers everywhere, particular paper, the mulberry fiber that I use in my current work. I guess as a Korean, like you grew up kind of wrapped around in this particular paper, not only you use it for calligraphy or, you know, for art and craft use, basically like, you know, it was used for flooring, you know, in traditional sense, not, you know, in a contemporary living situation now, but, you know, it was a window screen, it was lined interior of the furnitures, and so, you know, papers used everywhere, and you just kind of see that. And even there's a funerary clothing made in that paper. So, I mean, there are other options too, but one of the options is the mulberry fiber paper clothing. So, you could literally, you're given birth and you live wrapped around, and your body could be wrapped around when you die too in this paper. So it is kind of very just in your life, you know? So in one sense, for that reason, I wasn't as interested in exploring an earlier phase of my artistic journey, because I was just so familiar with it, and I didn't feel that kind of strong bond until later.
Right, right. And now you're referring to it as paper mulberry, but what? Tell us the Korean name.
Yeah, it's hanji, which is literally Korean paper. Right. And that is, some people think that rice, grass was used, or it is really inner bark of mulberry, 100%. So that's the paper.
Yeah. Did you grow up in the city or where in Korea?
I grew up in Seoul. Okay. Very dense, densely populated, and in high rise and a condo. That's kind of my early upbringing, surrounded by high rise buildings.
Right, right. And so it sounds like you moved for high school or sort of middle of high school. And
I started out as sophomore. I was attending like art magnet middle school and high school, part of high school. And I came and started as a 10th grader here.
Okay. And is that how did that come about? I know you said you had relatives. Who put that in your mind, or did you have that idea? Or
I was kind of very adventurous person. And so I was floating that idea, just thinking about different opportunity as a, creative person, because I think any of the training, early training in Korean context is just kind of one way of learning. And I think I wanted to try it different ways. So I was dreaming and I was just kind of testing my boundary. And there was no way as like 13, 14 years old girl could just kind of, just pack up and go somewhere else. So I'll just keep bringing up, exploring that idea with my parents. And they had some international work opportunity that they were in planning stage. And I was advocating me and my brother should go while that is in plan so we can better prepare ourselves if we're going to go later stage.
Ah,
And
okay.
that kind of somehow worked with them. And went first and then made it easier for me to
Okay.
already have older brother who's there living, and I could just join him. So year after I joined him.
Okay. And so it sounds like you were already creative. What kind of creative things were you doing?
So I was drawing and painting ever since like really early, but I think it was a fifth grader. I really enter, quote unquote, enter to this more serious way of learning art. And it's very French kind of academy style. Maybe some Russian, I'm not sure, but it is very Western kind of modernist or classic, based training. That I was going to this after school program after my school. And I was there until like 10 p.m. just drawing and painting. And that kind of prepared me. I did the whole entrance exam for this magnet school. It was very selective, highly competitive. And to get in, like you just needed to kind of master as well as you can as a, 11, 12 years old to draw a certain way, paint a certain way. So, and I did that school for middle school, and I did prepare yet a like another entrance exam for high school, and I enter into this magnet high school, but then I, just left everything behind, wanting to come here to study.
Okay. So you went to LA then, is that right?
Yeah, I was in actually Orange County.
Orange County. Okay. And wow, how was that transition? And yeah, what happened creatively?
It was fun. I think as a creative person, just being plugged into a new community with different like stimulus, just everything was new, just w different way of living, different schedules. Everything was very exciting, and I had pretty good time, although language barrier was different and cultural difference was still kind of part of being, fun and exciting thing to learn, So I think my high school was really fun.
And did you say it was an arts high school?
Yes, I went to Orange County High School of the Arts. That was then I finished that, went to UCLA from there.
And what did you do at UCLA?
I entered as a fine art major, and then I was finally asking, who am I as an artist and what is art? So I was kind of going through that questioning stage. Then I try to pivot, and I go to actually France for study abroad, like beginning of my third year, and come back from it and change my major to media art, which is more design kind of base, because it was after really exploring, I had really this big self-doubt about me as an artist, and I thought I could work better with certain parameter with the client's needs and problem solving to meet that need. I felt like that was more of what I wanted to do. I major and graduate with the media art degree.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to It's such a long journey. Even now, I feel for myself like I'm still unfolding. who am I? What am I doing? What does my art mean? Yeah. Okay, and then you went on to graduate school, right?
Yeah. Actually, I worked as a designer, and I did that for a few years, and I get married. Then we moved to Massachusetts, and I go to architecture program at UMass Amherst.
Okay. And did you move for your husband or did he have work? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you decided to go into architecture, which I thought for a long time I would be an architect, mm-hmm. but I did not pursue that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then from architecture training, I discover the world of book arts. I guess that's kind of the narrative that you've been waiting for. Because that Western Mass happens to be kind of mecca for printmaking and artist books and fine bindings, right? Mm-hmm. So it is one of my professor at UMass who took the class trip to Daniel Kelm's book bindery. And because I was very curious about my professor, his name is Joseph Kruptinsky. He's still at UMass Amherst. I knew of like his background. He was architect, trained at Cooper Union, but he left New York City to Western Mass to study under this bookbinder. So I was like very curious. And finally, one day he takes us out to Daniel's bookbindery. And that was kind of the moment that I knew that I just have to try this, give it a shot. I asked Dan to give me an internship and and that's where everything started, me learning how to do books. Because I realized that there, I mean, I always wanted to do architecture. And one of the main reasons was this narrative qualities that you experience physically when you're walking, experiencing a good, like well-designed buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about, and you just like, you know, I'm not talking about Walmart going up and down the aisle, but, you know, like a really good, well-designed building always have that, you know, the visitor to experience a narrative quality. And I really felt like Daniel's book was kind of something in that sense. I felt really tight connection with my own desire, wanting to be an architect was that narrative quality that you can better express in a like a physical experience, you know? So whole experience of turning pages.
Right. I was just reading about something about you, you know, in preparation for this. And I think it was an article and you were talking about the book. It's being more personal.
Yeah.
You know, because one person at a time can look at it. As long as you can hold it. Sometimes they're in exhibitions or whatever, versus art in a public space, which you do too, and we'll get to that.
Yeah, this spatial experience is really one, I don't know, this one plane or whatever, one's like this very space at a time, and that whole quote-unquote reading experience of the spatial qualities and books. It just really like something sparked and I really needed to figure out what that was about. So that's kind of how I knew. And after spending some time working and learning different aspects of the bookbinding, I knew that I wasn't going to design buildings anymore.
Okay. So you did work with Daniel Kelm and
I was there for maybe overall, I mean, after I moved to Boston, I was keep coming out to Western Mass, but I think I spent like good 3 years with Dan and his staff at the bindery, which was one of the very special time.
Yeah, I can imagine. Wow, cool. Okay, and so then what happened?
Yeah, so, you know, I still wanted to finish my architecture program by designing buildings. So I ended up exploring that connection that I wanted to know more about. So I ended up designing a space that had book-like quality. And I also designed an artist book that explores spatial quality. So I kind of designed two parallel projects in book form and spatial form. And that's how I, you know, wrap up my architecture programming program and get out and start designing books and making other art.
Cool. Okay. And so you moved to Boston. I know you had a child still when you were on the East Coast. Yeah.
So, I got pregnant, moved out to Denver. It was also for my husband's job.
Okay.
8 weeks.
What does he do?
He's a radiologist.
Okay.
Yeah. And he looks at black and white imaging, very beautiful images, you know, although he can never see it that way because usually it's you know, imaging that has a lot of problems, you know,
right.
Serious health issues.
Yes. Okay. So what year did you move to Denver?
I moved here 2007. So I was here a little earlier than, when you arrived.
Okay. I was thinking it was closer. We moved in 2012. Mm-hmm. Okay. So 2007.
Yeah. So it's like 16th year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe 17th year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now.
And you're so immersed in the Denver art scene now. So how did you go about that? When did you have your first child? What year? So,
He was born February 2018. And I somehow agree to just completely be stay-home mom for like 2.5 years.
Okay.
So that's what I did. And I mean, it was hard enough because we were just establishing in a new place without any support. We didn't have any friends or family in Denver. So I think that was kind of hard transition. So 2.5 years, I completely stopped. And that time actually make me realize all the more that I have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So from that moment, so it was like, 2008. So it was it was 2011. I'm just making attempt to just, you know, start making work again. And I built a studio shed out in my, you know, backyard, you know, one lot that was available. I, you know, make that happen. But that the window facing from my studio was kitchen, and kitchen has a window facing my studio. So it was really, that kind of really symbolized my psychological space. I'll be in kitchen thinking about fantasizing of, oh gosh, I got to finish that thing that I started.
Right.
Then I'll be in the studio looking at my kitchen. I'm like, oh, got to cook dinner. I got to, you know, you know, make snacks for my kid. And, you know, it's just like, it was very splitted, and tension was just, I wasn't happy just kind of being either space.
Right. Right.
So, I did that and still try, you know, but you got great use out of the space. And, but I made more work and showing it around Denver and beyond too. Then I heard of Red Line, you know, I know that was one of the things that you're curious about, the residencies that I've done. I heard of Red Line, but I knew that I couldn't really do it. And by the time that I felt like I could increase like daycare hour and, you know, I think it was when Preston started preschool that I have to apply and, you know, try this. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a residency at Red Line, and it's a long, was it a year?
2 years.
Two years. And you get a studio and
a free studio. And you just have, they have amazing staff who's really clearly to the point that they're very sacrificial to support the resident artist to pursue their dream. So it is something that I really wanted to give it a shot because, like I said, that my studio arrangement was just facing each other with a, you know, the kitchen and studio facing each other, and I just couldn't really immerse myself in art making. So I wanted a space, and also just being isolated in Denver, like suburb in Denver, with young child, I just feel like I didn't know anybody in art community, so I wanted to be in that kind of new community and get to know the scene and just give myself the chance to really devote myself into something, even if it is during the school hour, like in a 9 to 3. You know, I wanted
right.
to
really, yeah. So how did your work
yeah.
develop there? And so you worked when he was in preschool, and I think you said he was born in 2018. I just want to correct. He was born
Eight.
in 2008,
Eight.
but you had another child, I think, in
It's
2018.
2015.
15. Okay.
Yeah. So I was getting some tractions from like 2000, like 12 to 15. So I was showing more. And 2016, early 2016 is when I applied for Redline. And
okay.
I get in.
Okay.
And that time, like, even with the second child just being born, newborn, like, my husband and I discussed about, you know, this is something that I cannot delay. You know, I've been just thinking about wanting to do this, but then here I am getting pregnant again. But I feel like, you know, we decide that we'll make it happen. So we got some, we hire a nanny, and, you know, we decided to make this happen. And I'm not really holding him for longer like the older child at home. We started like daycare, like from the second years. Yeah. So, yeah.
Right. I meant to ask this earlier, but did your parents end up in the United States? Because you
no,
said
not
no,
really.
they didn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They
Okay.
were, they gave it a shot a couple of times there, and they ended up moving back.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So the grandparents are far away. That's hard.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have several works that you, they just keep evolving, and I love how you do that, and maybe we can talk about a few of those pieces. What does it make sense to start with? I wanted to talk about your book Mammorial real quick, because that relates to motherhood, so tell me about that.
Yeah, Mammorial was actually made in 2017 based on you know, my second, I also think that my second child was kind of in the second chance to really enjoy that whole early stage of rearing, you know, baby, because first one, I just didn't know what I was doing. It was just way too stressful with being at a new place, isolated. So yeah, I'm just really thankful, although we didn't plan for another child, mainly because the first experience was so hard on us, but it, you know, but peers happened, and we felt like it was second chance that was given, and I was able to process more, you know, fully, instead of just kind of just going through feeling like it was just too hard. So
right.
I think even breastfeeding experience too, I was really thinking about the whole experience and how what women go through psychologically, physically. So I was giving more chance to reflect on things. So from that reflection, I wanted to talk about this interesting sense of duality of pride and shame around breastfeeding. You know, certain moms were almost like condescending of those other moms who couldn't, you know, or who chose not to breastfeed. And so there was just all these different, very strong opinions around things amongst moms and public breastfeeding. So there are just many stories to talk about. And I just did some researches based on those two ideas of pride and shame, but wanted to really present that narrative in a very natural way, because it is a phase, very natural phase that women go through. And
let me just say, the book is called, let's just spell the name of the book, because I said it quickly and it sounds kind of like memorial, but it's Mammorial, Mammorial. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had main visual images, mammary gland from the beginning of breastfeeding until the end of it. So I have 18 radiology imaging of mammary gland, which very much similar to just botanical image of a branch with a lot of just like budding and leaves, you know, and then withering and just drying out. It like if I don't tell anyone, it will just resemble that.
Right. And
But
we'll put a photo in the show notes of this book. Yeah.
yeah. So that is a main visual of it. And the main story or text is the actually sound of breast pump. So it starts with just motor sound of whoosh, 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 like the motor sound. But then as you turn pages from third or fourth image, it starts to talk to you. Because that's my personal experience of like, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning,
Right.
like it started talking to me and I thought I was going crazy. So I Googled the next morning, the breast pump is talking to me. And then I discovered there are whole other women out there hearing. So I compiled everything that I found of all these things that women heard. And it is because they're, you know, fatigue, you know,
Yeah.
like, you know, and if it's repetitive sound, their brain is trying to make sense out of it. So they're hearing all these different things. So
Right.
this is kind of showing basically it's the same sound, but depends on your where your mind is. You're, you know, hearing different things, right? So that is reflecting the psychological state of these women. So the imaging is showing the physical, you know, changes that women go through. So it is just that to, you know, it's that idea kind of, you know, of that change. So that is shown in trifold pages that you can kind of see the image and you have text. And also there is a one more layer of handmade paper covering radiology image of breast, which shows tissue because it's I was able to literally make the tissue out of the mulberry fiber again.
Oh,
And
okay.
it's showing how that dense tissue is thinning as you turn pages. So it shows those element. And I have an essay talking about just the story behind all these changes. Because after all, it's one of the highest plastic surgery kind of requests. Yeah. All these women want to go to the pre-birthing body and the breastfeeding, like number one thing they want to change. So what does that mean, you know, as a container or a tool to feed baby and just kind of yeah, maybe source of some like youthful, perky breastfeeding, that kind of empowering like femininity or you know, whatever that it is. I just wanted to you know, explore different ideas in that essay. So that was that book. And
Yeah, and is that an addition?
yeah, it is addition that actually I'm working now right now to kind of fulfill some of the standing order.
Okay. And so how many in
I
that
think it'll be
edition?
26.
26.
Yeah.
Okay. This episode of Paper Talk is sponsored by the Red Cliff Paper Retreat, an annual retreat held at Helen Hebert's studio in the heart of the Rocky Mountains of Colorado in late August. Enjoy a peaceful, creative week in the tiny hamlet of Red Cliff, surrounded by mountains, the river, and aspen trees. Experiment with several techniques as you create a variety of paper objects that will intrigue your eyes and illuminate your spirit. All levels of art experience are invited. The 2023 retreat theme is paper panels. Come explore a variety of papers that can be made by hand, cut, folded, stitched, and assembled in a variety of ways to create books, wall hangings, sculpture, lighting, and more. Explore these ideas as you create unique paper objects with a dozen like-minded creatives. Find out more at helenhebertstudio.com/red-cliff-paper-retreat. Yeah, I feel a personal connection because I made a piece also about breastfeeding, but it's a giant sculpture called Mother Tree, and it has crocheted mother's milk that changes into roots that surround the piece. And
I think I've seen that installation.
yeah, and it's just was like literally the weight of, the milk in your breasts and your
baby wanting to nurse and the pain. And
yeah.
So, yeah, there's so much around.
I think breastfeeding was harder than the birthing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 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 So let's talk a little bit about your work with paper. And maybe we can turn to a very proper table setting. And I saw that recently, maybe it had a different name then, at the Denver Botanic Garden.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little about the thinking behind the piece, but also the way that you are working with paper.
Yeah. So that one, very proper table, like I said, I created my very first table cast out of my memory. And that one was just huge plate with two small kind of bowls next to it with the spoon and chapstick. And that was very first meal that I had the night of arriving the U.S. from Korea.
Okay.
And the dinner was set up by my aunt, who had been in the state for maybe over 25-year-ish at then.
Mm-hmm.
And she set up this buffet and she just handed out big plate and say, oh, go get what you want, how much, you know, amount that you want. And I came back just sitting and watching, you know, rice and other things. And there were also the dishes are kind of Korean American dishes.
Mm.
Like it was little familiar, unfamiliar, those things all on a plate, kind of sauces are mixing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure if I like it or not, you know, mm-hmm. but I was like, oh, it must be a, you know, way of becoming Korean hyphenated American. So, because Korean meal, I'm not sure whether you're familiar, but it is served in all individual bowls and, you know, dishes. And,
right.
And there are a lot of kind of labor and thoughts prepared to balance texturally, nutritionally, color, everything, you know, a lot of things, you know, there's a balance and a lot. So you're sometimes, so it is a way, definitely a way to express love and care, but mm-hmm. then you were kind of pressured to finish everything too, that is given to you. So there is a kind of beyond, you know, idea of, yeah, so that's kind of the idea of Korean meal. And that was the first one that I created to talk about just the different culture and exploring the bowls and dishes as a container for the culture.
Mm-hmm.
But that experience and also my own experience of wanting to find the perfect bowl for 7 years in this U.S. to recreate my family's noodle recipe, I thought about, yeah, you know, there's all this proper way of serving, you know, this dishes. And I want to have this direct engagement with people from different culture, putting their culture into these containers that I bring to them. So from that, I started 2017 to go to random places in Denver area
mm-hmm.
With my, you know, dinnerwares, Korean dinnerware, to do this exercise with people. So I give basically three prompts for them to think of someone special in their life. So it starts with a person.
Mm-hmm.
Then I ask them to set an imaginary meal. But because they start with someone special in their life, usually the dishes get pretty specific what they want to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And like, even if it is like a Thanksgiving meal per se,
mm-hmm.
What I give them is Korean serving vessels. So they have to do a little bit of like reinventing,
mm-hmm.
you know, they have to maybe, you know, yeah, they have to find different, they have to look at all these bowls and find perfect one to serve their meal, serve their particular dishes. So there is a little bit of a cross-cultural exercise, you know, thinking that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea how it's going to evolve. You know, I just wanted to give it a shot, kind of reflecting my own experience of, you know, cereal bowl, finding cereal bowl too small to hold that noodle.
Right.
Or to use salad bowl, it's just too big, and you know, just like not having, you know, it's kind of Goldilocks. It's too small, too big. There's nothing perfect to really recreate my tradition. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be kind of fun thing to, you know, reverse it. Mm-hmm. And challenge to people. So it started from that. And from 2017, I had maybe like 10 different opportunities to host these pop-ups at various neighborhoods. And when I later, when I had more options, I specifically went to different neighborhoods with different demographic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the one installation that you saw,
I just want to ask before you go there, mm-hmm. I want you to describe, so these different pop-up events, did you have a group there and they were all having different, or were you doing a one-on-one? And then describe the paper. Do you do the paper part there and describe what you're making? Because we'll put a visual, but
yeah. So I had some samples that I've done available so people can see what they're doing will turn into that. But okay. Not at the moment, as you know, it's impossible to make it dry while we're running that pop-up. So I gather the information from these pop-up, showing mm-hmm. them, some of them wanting to keep in touch with me so they can see that later. I just gather information at the pop-up.
Okay, so written information?
Yeah, so I just give them like a 3x5 card and they put their name, who they're setting it for.
Okay.
And the meal that they set up, then I take picture with their arrangement. Okay. So I have the record of everything. When I go to studio, I can recreate that.
Right. So can you describe what you're recreating and the paper you're using?
Yeah. So I guess the traditional technique name is jumchi, but basically it's a felting mm-hmm. paper. Mm-hmm. And idea is very simple. You know, if you layer papers and agitate, you know, while it's wet, then this very fine papers will interlock through that agitation, and it will felt into one singular substrate that is thicker. And while you're doing that felting process of basically just, you know, crumpling, throwing, pounding, a different way of agitating fiber, it develops very nice quality. It transforms the quality and strength and appearance of it. So I go through and the result mimics, I mean, I have different way of making it look more like fabric or leather, but so because of that animal hide-like quality that I see and very much like, I call that substrate paper skin. So once mm-hmm. I have a felted paper skin, then I usually apply three methods. One is I hang and stretch while it's wet so that the gravity or tension will be recorded as it's drying out. Mm-hmm. Or even the weight of water, you know, it just gets all recorded on the surface texture. And second is that I cast, so the very proper table setting is that category. I cast it and remove the object, so it is a relief. And thirdly, I wrap object, and object is still inside or, you know, underneath it, and that is, you know, the suitcase series or mama bots, or I have, so those are kind of main, you know, three different ways that I work once I have felt to substrate.
Right. And you have those listed under paper on your website, and you can mm-hmm. go, listeners, you can go look at the different pieces where she's using these different techniques. Mm-hmm. So I'm a nerd, and the people listening are paper, mm-hmm. really interested in paper. So tell us what is the paper you're using and where you're getting it and to make your substrate.
Yeah. I mean, I've been going to Korea quite often, almost yearly, So whenever I come back, you know, my suitcase is full of paper. Mm-hmm. And I also directly order sometime too. And I know the Hiromi Paper International.
Yes.
Yeah, they carry hanji too. So it is a mulberry hanji handmade one. So listeners can find that online source.
Yeah, Hiromi Paper is a great supplier. Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. And so talk a little bit about like this very proper table setting.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it, I think most recently was exhibited at the Denver Botanic Garden, but I think it's moved around and it's somewhere right now. I think it is, it's now, there's part of it hanging. So how do you sort of move these pieces around and keep them growing and evolving?
So I think that the thing that you mentioned about both my project, maybe more than this project suitcase, it usually they tend to be modular and they evolve. And I think it's because I see my projects as kind of way of answering myself with certain questions and search. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if the Botanic Garden show will be a culmination point and I move on from there.
Mm-hmm.
But then once I had it for the first time seeing the entire gallery wrapped around with a table setting, it's actually taking me to the next place. So it is really very natural process of I had all these questions and I kind of pursue that and I get to a point then I have different revelation.
Right.
So I think that's what's happening with many of my projects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So right now, currently, after the Botanic Garden show, until I think mid-May, I have a different iteration of table setting at Denver Art Museum, Creative Hub space. So if any of the local listener is able to check it out and you see, and I arrange it in a way that it is like a kind of land, you know, particularly like a lunar surface, lunar landscape was, and I titled it Moonlight in Colorado. That was a title for that.
Okay.
So it is another, you know, because I did the Denver Botanic Garden show, I'm able to go there, you know, start seeing tables, individual table setting that holds individual narrative, being part of the bigger landscape, and I'm asking questions about, what is this, you know, landscape about? What is all this kind of visually? I see different spaces, negative spaces in between how it was installed, and I'm beginning to see maybe divisions and social divisions and whatever that kind of takes away from each other from this collective narrative. And I find dinner table or this meal tradition great way to start talking about that too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's able to take me to the next place with it. So that's when I realized, oh, I'm not done with this series yet.
Right. Yeah, thank you so much for reflecting on that, because I think the older we get too, the more we think about how things earlier in life relate to what's happening now, and it's all a journey and a process, and the things we think about relate to what we make, and we make the things that we think about, and thank you. Let's talk about your piece, Arrived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Arrived is also locally at Museum of Contemporary Art, Denver.
Okay.
Denver until May 28th. And showing iteration, exploring idea of adequate shelter. That is a term, that's UN's term.
Mm.
and each state interpretate and give different actual square footage number. But state of Colorado, it's 150 square foot. So suitcase is actually creating wall to make a, you know, define approximate that, you know, 150 square foot in that installation. And that
okay, so you are wrapping suitcases with mm-hmm. paper and arranging them into the to take yeah. up that amount of space. Okay.
Yeah, so suitcases kind of like a bricks to create the walls to make that. And mm-hmm. suitcases, those wrapped suitcases first shown at Red Lion Show in 2017. Mm-hmm. And it has gone through many different kind of iteration, one being tower piles and standing up in line, very personified, like a family mm-hmm. at court. It just, but main narrative about that is immigration mm-hmm. and each suitcase being filled with someone's consolidated life, because when someone's leaving their home, they are really thinking about their life and select those objects that they cannot live without, right?
Right.
So that those suitcases are filled with object that is so unique to each person's life, yet at the arrival, it is just black anonymous suitcase that could be mistaken as. And I just felt that was very much like the immigrant identity mm-hmm. And having that experience of packing myself as, you know, 16-year-old mm-hmm. And that very suitcase are part of the installation at MCA too. So that suitcase is not necessarily really travel or, you know, or what you're going to wear when you're in Paris. You know, it's not that. It's
right.
Really, like permanently being displaced and moving to somewhere else and editing your life, you know, and packing into that bags.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So that has, yeah, cool. We'll put a couple of different versions of how that's been exhibited.
Mm-hmm. Like another version was a tower form. It was at Emmanuel Gallery in my solo show. And that tower was just floor to ceiling stacked tower of suitcases that was meant to collapse. And it collapsed three times during the exhibition. And I display a collapse form and trace that with tape. Different colored tape, and I restacked them during duration of the exhibition. So that was, you know, another iteration. So
yeah,
it is black hanji that I, you know, apply over suitcase, and I use varnishing. I painted with sumi ink and varnish, very much like painterly process to give them more of the expression. So it's a glossy finished so that it appear as like, you know, bodily liquid, you know, sweat or, you know, tears. So from afar, it looks just black suitcases. But mm-hmm. when you approach it, when you go up close, then you could see all those textures, wrinkles, and, you know, attentions and those shimmery reflections on, and they're all different. Mm-hmm. So I think that was kind of very expressive.
Right.
While being subtle.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm saying a lot about the immigrant experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I know you were recently at Anderson Ranch, and I just want to mm-hmm. hear a little bit about that, because I think you were making furniture. I was following a little bit on Instagram.
Yeah. I made table there.
Uh-huh.
Another thing for the very proper table setting project.
Okay.
So I made a table and the tabletop is glass and top and the bottom. So there, you know, tables are kind of made with the two panels of glass where I can insert table setting from my, you know, my family. Like, we're a family of four. Mm-hmm. I asked my mom to draw our typical dinner. So I'm going to cast that. And so that will be our family tradition will be kind of memorialized in between these two planes of table. And my current family of also four will dine over that. And I wanted to see our hands, you know, elbows, our eating experience that, you know, I'm going to video those experiences.
Uh-huh.
And how that interacts with the memorialized family tradition underneath. So I had to kind of make a table that can have two glass, you know, panels. That's why I had to customize it. And it was really fun to make that.
Oh, cool. And for listeners who don't know, Anderson Ranch is a wonderful place in Snowmass, Colorado, near Aspen. They offer workshops and have lots of residencies. And I'm curious, did you have that idea before you went for the residency or did it?
Yeah.
So you proposed that?
I might have proposed something different.
Uh-huh.
But again, Botanic Gardens show that ended in February kind of gave me desire wanting to explore the layered tradition.
Right, right.
Exploring that personal history of the tradition. So I had that idea of wanting to make table, and I had obviously option to just, you know, hire a carpenter to create that. But, you know, when I knew that Anderson Ranch has amazing wood, you know, facility, mm-hmm. I felt like I could make it, you know, there.
Right.
That was kind of planned project. And there are many kind of spontaneous projects that I got to do, you know, along with that table making.
Right. And were there several residents there?
Yeah.
So it's a whole experience. Yeah.
Yeah. There are many talented residents that you get to spend, you know, 5 weeks, you know, during the springtime and 10 weeks during the wintertime.
Okay. Wonderful. Wow.
And again, their support from the staff is really amazing too. Yeah. I was very grateful. Yeah,
and I'm sure technical support on how to use the different tools and things. Yeah,
also they arrange like studio visits, and all their staff—they're all artists too.
Right,
it's amazing to just be in a community that artists help each other.
Right, cool, cool. So, what are you working on now? This podcast probably won't come out until June. I'm not exactly sure. So what you've just mentioned, those shows are going to be down, but we'll put plenty of pictures in the show notes.
It's a very proper table setting with that video that I just talked about from the table that I made. Will be displayed in two shows, one in Los Angeles and New York City in June. So LA show opens in June 8th. The New York City show opened in June 24th. So I need to really start making that video. I have a teaching in Lana Pool, you know, near Cannes in France.
Oh, okay.
It's through Art Student League, and it is artist book workshop that I'm teaching. And once I come back from it, I actually am on a Fulbright assignment to South Korea for 10 months. So I'll be going there as of August 1st and get to spend 10 months in South Korea, researching definitely more the paper and different paper techniques and food tradition. I'll be taking some cooking classes. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And will your family go with you or what's happening
taking the little one. Yeah.
Okay, so he'll get an experience as well.
A high schooler will remain in Denver.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That's wonderful. I noticed the Fulbright Scholar on your website, and I'm glad you brought it up. Wow. Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah, I have a chance to do the in-depth research on the material and concept too. So I think, again, you know, some of my project will evolve from this time. Yeah.
Right. Do you think you will you have a space to work during that time or is it mostly research? No, you will work. Yeah.
Yeah, I will work and I will have probably an exhibition opportunity toward the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wonderful.
make sure that I'm not just doing the I don't know, just like I think I'll be very flexible. So I'll do enough of kind of playing time, you know, as well. But yeah, I will continue to create work there too.
Right. Wow. Cool. Okay. And we didn't go over this before, but I sent you, I said that I asked for recommendations. So I don't know if you had anything in mind. We also, we already talked about Hiromi paper, which I'll put down.
Yeah. The recommendations, you know, I actually spent some time thinking about it, but I know the listeners, they're the phase and journey in their creative field are all different. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, rather than anything specific, I think for me, what really work is just start from, you know, who you are, you know, mm-hmm. That's where that the voice, your creative voice, will be the strongest. Mm-hmm. And I think, and you have full authority of telling your own story. So I think that's kind of where it started for me. And I think that was one thing that I can leave you guys with. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great recommendation. Highly, mm-hmm. highly good. Okay. And where can we find you online?
My website is studiosmlk.com, and I'm also on Instagram under Sammy_Seungmin_Lee, and Seungmin is my Korean name spelled as Seungmin.
Yeah, and I'll put that in the show notes as well, listeners. And let's wrap up with one more thing I forgot to talk about, which is your collective, SMLK.
Yeah. So it is it is actually making my life very exciting,
mm-hmm.
but very busy. It's mm-hmm. it's another baby. It takes a lot of time, but yeah. I have residency and curatorial and just artist collaborative projects, and I have a physical space. So I quarterly host artists from out of Colorado to bring them into my collective to just give them platform to explore and, you know, plug into the network in Denver to make connections, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I made mission just because we didn't have any platform to talk about contemporary Asian art. That is my main focus and main vision, but I'm always open and flexible to collaborate. Anyone who wants to bring unique narrative into Denver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's cool. So you have an actual space where an artist can come and work, and then you...
Yeah,
you spend time.
Space. Yeah, live work space that is just not along that Santa Fe Art District area.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But if they come and, you know, be part of that art walk too, if they want to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in a very fun and exciting artist neighborhood in Denver.
Yeah, that's really great. Important work. Well, thank you so much, Sammy, for coming on the show. It's been a real treat talking to you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really nice to talk about my work. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert's studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
besides the season, the main contain.